Good morning. My name is Michael Dean. I'm a member of the steering committee, and it's my pleasure to host today's session. But before I introduce today's speaker, I have sad news that Judith referenced already. Tom Heck passed away this past Sunday. Tom and his wife, Ann, have been an integral part of Word in Life and served on the steering committee for the past 15 years. Tom also handled audio-visual duties while we were meeting in person, and up until pretty recently, managed our website. One of Tom's many talents was his musical ability. He was always ready to play and sing a song when we were gathered together. So in his honor and memory, I'd like to share the following musical video of one of the songs that he loved to sing and captures his wonderful spirit.
I see trees of green. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They learn much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful
rest in peace, Tom, as we send our love, our prayers, and our condolences to Anne. The Reverend Canon Ron David, MD, is joining us today all the way from North Carolina. I came to be acquainted with Ron, which is what he likes to be called, while he was serving as chaplain, spiritual director, and supervisor of clinical pastoral care at Good Samaritan Hospital in Los Angeles. We were always thrilled at Trinity Episcopal Church whenever he came to visit and preach. And I should stop there because I see Mark Asman is with us. So thank you, Mark, for inviting Ron so often. Anyway, we were thrilled with him when he preached because his words and his wisdom were so informed and inspired by his training, both as a physician and a priest. He was the first person I thought of when we began recruiting speakers for this series. I am so pleased he was able to join us today, and I'm so honored to introduce him. Ron, the Zoom stage is yours.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, friends and family of Word and Life. It is an honor for me to be here with you and to revisit good old Trinity Church. Even though it's only a virtual visit, it is better than no visit. I'm glad to be here, and especially in the presence of my former rector, Mark Asman, and my former spiritual director. In many ways, she remains my spiritual director, and that is Ann Jacqua. Good morning to you both. I would like to share with you lots of thoughts that have to do with my personal and professional experience as a priest and physician, but I'm duty-bound to reflect with you on today's chapter. The chapter du jour is simply titled, It's Not Easy. And it invites the question, what is it that is not easy? And why is it hard? It's not evident in Bishop Michael Curry's book, in that particular chapter, what it is that's not easy. So I was left free to free associate and imagine. Some of the thoughts that come to mind is perhaps sticking to my job and letting God do God's work is what is the challenge and the difficulty. But I began to think of it more as discerning my vocation and accepting whatever our specific vocations may be. There is one shared destiny and desire that we all have, and that is to grow and the knowledge and love of God and God's creation. So it matters not if you are an aquanaut or astronaut, a mountain climber or coal miner, a carpenter or plumber, a physician or physicist, a farmer or grocer, or a preacher or parishioner. The task requires discipline, but in the end, it isn't very hard to discern one's vocation and how to go along the way to growing in the knowledge and love of God and all of God's creation. The other thought that came to me was that perhaps what is hard is the struggle against social, economic, and political injustices, undoing the pernicious and intractable poverty and racism. These are signals that the poor or persons of color are worthless or unworthy. And if justice is a social form of love, injustice is lovelessness. Where there is no justice, there is no love. Perhaps the author intends for us to recognize that the thing that is not easy is taking up our crosses and following Jesus. Or maybe we could link the title of this chapter with the title of the book and simply inquire, what is love and why is it hard? And to imagine that living with love is the way that is hard. Even if that is so, the question is begged, what is love and why is it hard? So I want to go a little ways in unpacking that. I think in the time that you've met already and times you will meet in reflecting on this book in the future, you will hear many definitions of love. It will sometimes be explicit and often implicit. But I want to add to the layer of definitions about love. My favorite definition comes from the theologian Paul Tillich. And he writes, if you give me a moment, I want to call up a screen to share with you. Thank you for your patience. For Paul Tillich, love is the drive towards the unity of the separated. Reunion presupposes separation of that which belongs together, essentially. And the corollary to that is that it's impossible to unite things that are not essentially separated. So love is the drive toward the unity of the separated. And I'm going to build on that for our reflections this morning. If you remember nothing else of what I have to share with you, it may be helpful to hold on to this key phrase. It came to me as an epiphany some 25 years ago when I was trying to understand why we focus so heavily on death and dying and arguing that the purpose of life is to live as long as possible without disease or illness. And it occurred to me in those reflections and contemplations that relationships are primary. All else is derivative. And so I want to build on Tillich's understanding of love and my personal experience of love in a way that helps us to remember why it is that relationships are primary and all else is derivative. You know the great commandments, love God and love thy neighbor as thyself. And I would like to suggest that the command is not love your neighbor in the same way that you love your seemingly separate individual self. Rather, it is to know that your neighbor and you are one self, inextricably bound, blessed and beloved. Now, the goal is not to lose ourselves in relationship. This is the paradox and the caution. The goal is not to lose ourselves in relation. That would be an unhealthy fusion, but it is to define and to find ourselves in relationship. It is to both differentiate and integrate all at once. Carol Gilligan, who writes about a different voice, suggests that it is typical for men to develop morally differentiated, and it is typical for women to develop morally as communal beings and integrating. But the argument here, this love that I'm speaking of now, is a love that is androgynous, that is both differentiated and integrated at the very same time. So that's an important caveat to bear in mind. Paraphrasing the book of Acts, we learn that we live and move and have our being in relationship, through relationships, and for the very sake of relationships. Bishop Desmond Tutu, favorite son of the Xhosa people of South Africa, tells us of his community's ethos, the ethos of Ubuntu. A person is a person through other persons. Simple. Karl Marx even gets in on the argument when he states simply, the self is an ensemble of social relations. You think about it, whenever you're introduced to someone or you want to get to know someone, they will begin to identify themselves in relationship to others. I am the great grandfather of one lovely great granddaughter, the grandfather of five lovely granddaughters. I'm husband to Debbie David. I am a former physician, a retired priest. All of these are ways of defining themselves in the context of the ensemble of social relationships that we are a part of. Now, the notion of inseparability applies not only to human beings, it is true of the entire cosmos as we know it. And I want to ask you to use your imagination and consider chaos theory and quantum entanglement as examples. Quantum entanglement, another name for that, as defined by Albert Einstein, is spooky action at a distance. Be patient with me here in these slides. I want to give you, with a cartoon, an example of what is meant by spooky action at a distance, or quantum entanglement. I think that this video will not be easily audible to you. I'll start it out, and if you can hear it, you can't hear it. So I'm going to read to you the transcript that goes along with this particular video. Can you hear my voice? I get a couple of nods of the head.
Yes, we hear you.
Thank you. Here, Professor Q, and the Q is for quantum, not for Q-Nog, so don't mistake the two. But Professor Q is describing to us that entanglement crushes our experience of space. Two objects, electrons or photons, created together are entangled. Send one to the other side of the universe. Now, do something to one and the other instantly responds, instantly. So, either information is traveling infinitely fast, or in reality, they are still touching, entangled. And since everything was entangled at the moment of the Big Bang, that means everything is still touching. Space is a construct that gives the illusion that objects are separate. And the professor ends this little video with the question, are you far enough down the rabbit hole yet? It is difficult for us to imagine that we are, in fact, so intimate a relationship with one another, because we don't typically think of relationships qua ex relationships, relationships as it resolves and revolves around the essence of that intimacy. And that's what I want to build on. Relatedness is the very texture of the universe. Relationships are primary. All else is derivative. Another example of spooky action at a distance is compassion. I want to say something about compassion, but distinguish it from empathy. The two words are related, but they are not synonymous. For one thing, the word compassion appears in scripture, as in Jesus had compassion for the sheep without a shepherd. The word empathy, on the other hand, does not appear at all in scripture, and that is because the word was only invented in the early 1900s by a Professor Titchener, who was seeking a way to measure the experience of aesthetics. How do we decide something is beautiful or not? And so the appreciation of the viewer of the artistic painting, for example, is a kind of aesthetic that Dr. Titchener wanted to try to measure. So compassion and empathy are two different things, but they're related. And neuroscientists tell us that there's a different circuitry in the brain for compassion, or what we're calling compassion, and for empathy. Empathy requires the capacity of a frontal lobe to tell stories, to narrate experiences. For example, empathy amplifies compassion because when we see someone in pain, we may not necessarily feel the pain, but we can imagine, oh, that looks like it might be painful. It could be someone from our own tribe that we recognize. And because of that recognition, our sense of compassion, which is something that occurs to us immediately without any mediating story, any mediating events, compassion is visceral, and you might say that it is in many ways intuitive or instinctual. And if we have empathy for someone in the face of our compassion, we are more likely to come to their aid. Apathy, on the other hand, denies the experience of compassion. It is maybe better described as compassion fatigue. I know that walking through Los Angeles often, headed to the Good Samaritan Hospital, I could see a number of homeless individuals. And I stopped carrying coins in my pocket so that I didn't have to respond to the panhandlers, the homeless. That's apathy on my part. I had the compassionate feelings, but they were overridden or disguised or stifled by the sense of apathy. And so I sought to ignore the other. Worst of these is antipathy. Not only do we not recognize the automatic instinctual experience of compassion, we vilify the other. And I dare to argue that our political and social economy is so constructed that there has to be in this construction the very wealthy, a large group of middle class, and a great number of poor. That is a function of an economic and political construction. And so rather than acknowledge that, what we do is we find ourselves in anger with those who are poor. And we construct additional social policy and economic policy to, in a word, to harm the poor. And that's part of the argument that I think our current president, Biden, is trying to help us overcome, to transform our policies in a way that recognizes the humanity and even the victimhood of the poor. Empathy, apathy, and antipathy. One of the forms of this entanglement that I've been trying to describe is chaos theory in mathematics. You may have heard of this, and I won't pretend to be a good mathematician and try to work this through for us mathematically. But there is a phenomenon in chaos theory, what is called the butterfly effect. There is in the world these chaotic phenomena that seem to have no organization, except as we watch them progress over time, these systems, for example, when a butterfly flaps its wings, it helps to spawn a tornado in Texas. That's a poetic metaphor, but it is a way of describing this interconnectedness of all things in the universe. So if what I say is true about love, this drive towards the unity of things that have been separated, why is this drive toward reunion so hard? And I want to share with you now two vignettes. One is of my personal experience, and the other is of my professional experience. Let me say something first so that the personal experience comes home to you a little more poignantly. This is a study of the experience of pain as it impacts the person who is witnessing pain. There are two patients here. On my left is a woman patient, and on the right is a man. And in both instances, there's the facial expression of an acute provoke pain. You can see the intensity on the face of the patient. On the other is the experience of a chronic pain. Now, if I did a magnetic resonance imaging on these two patients, I could see in their brains the place where blood flow and oxygen consumption increases because it is the area of the brain that is experiencing the pain. The interesting thing is these MRIs are not of the patients that I showed you, but these are the MRIs of the patient's caretaker. so that a nurse or a physician who comes into the room and sees the patient's face, that caretaker's blood flow will go to the area of the brain that registers pain. Now, most of the time, that won't be noticed by the caretaker. However, there are some of us who are what is called synesthetes. That is, there's a mixture of their seeing and feeling experiences. They see the pain and they feel the pain. They see someone touch their cheek, they feel something touching their own cheek. Those are synesthetes. And these MRIs that I'm showing you now are those of a person who is witnessing pain. And there's something curious about this mechanism for witnessing pain. Naomi Eisenberger, UCLA, has done studies to show that people who have the experience of being isolated and alienated, their brains light up in the same area in which they are experiencing physical pain. The body knows, pardon me, the body knows when a person is socially alienated and isolated. And so the pain of poverty is in many ways literal. It is experienced, that pain of isolation and alienation is experienced in the same area of the brain, the limbic area of the brain, that the pain that is physical is experienced. And I give you that long and elaborated narrative because I want to share with you the experience that makes for me following the way hard. Not impossible, but it is hard. And I think you might understand why. This is Derek Chauvin. Most of you will recognize his face, if not his name. He is the assailant in the death of George Floyd, an African-American. And the challenge in this instance is to practice the forgiveness that I preach as an Episcopal priest. That challenge is hard. Again, not impossible. It is hard because it's amplified as Officer Chauvin walked into the courtroom, not only as a defendant in this particular case, but as a stand-in for the slave patrol and Jim Crow vigilante precursors of contemporary policing. As such, I am repulsed by his utter disregard for the plight of the man dying unseen under the knee of Officer Chauvin in the picture on your left. If we didn't know better, we might imagine that Officer Chauvin is simply issuing a traffic citation. In both pictures, Chauvin's look is one of depraved indifference, a bewildering admixture of apathy and antipathy. Now, depraved indifference is a legal construct, not a psychological clinical diagnosis. Still, I'm drawn to the inner woundedness revealed on Derek Chauvin's face. I see in his face a deep woundedness, and hence his inability to know or register the pain that is of the man who is dying under his knee. And at the risk of trivializing the gravity of this tableau, I'm reminded of a ditty some of you will remember from the play West Side Story, when the gang members of the West Side, in dialogue with Officer Krupke, they sing this ditty: "Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents. We're just misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good." And then we hear the judge in a later sequence say, "Hey, he's depraved on account of he's deprived." I think that Derek Chauvin's depravity is a function of some inner wound, some time in his life, the trauma of being separate from people who might have nurtured him compassionately so that he would know that compassion. So my challenge is to endeavor to go through the narrow gate and hard road of that leads to life, that is the way of love. I have this sense of compassion for this man, my brother. And my hope is that our search for justice isn't a code word for revenge, but a word that calls us to reunite with one another for whatever reasons they are torn asunder from more meaningful and mutually supportive and challenging relationships. I think Derek Chauvin deserved that. And it may not be for me to forgive him for his crime. I'd leave that to his family and to their God. But I do imagine that my God calls me to remove from my own heart the crust of a history that is not George or Derek Chauvin's history, not caused by him, but one he too, like me, experienced. If we can continue to seek the kind of justice that is really a corrosive or corrupt sense of wanting revenge, where we can learn to love one another and pray for each other's healing. And I have to tell you as well, as I think about Derek Chauvin and what I've shared with you just this morning, there is in me a little bit of anxiety that I might be seen as a race traitor, that I, as an African American, should not have compassion for this man, particularly for the history that he represents. But it is, I'm agreeing with Bishop Curry here, it is the only path to a life rich in love. Now, I want to turn to you for, I'll say it's a professional and clinical reason for embracing this theology, but it is also personal. I'm going to put it under the umbrella of professional and clinical, though. Understand, underneath this is my experience personally. There is no concern greater for me than the lives and well-being of children and their parents, particularly infants and their mothers. Many of you may know that the United States infant mortality rate ranks 33rd out of 36 industrialized nations in the world, near the bottom of industrialized nations in terms of the risk of dying and early childbirth for both mother and child. Now, the traditional path to addressing this disgraceful standing is to view and treat women, especially the poor and women of color, as ignorant, immoral, incompetent, and/or irresponsible in bearing and rearing children. Unless you believe or think that I'm being hyperbolic, I can tell you and provide for you, if you're interested, loads of research literature, press articles that either explicitly or implicitly, and often callously explicitly, describe the problem as one caused by women themselves, with no effort whatsoever to examine the social milieu that is a toxic milieu for mothers and infants at this delicate stage of their development and evolution. So in 2007, I had the privilege and honor to create and co-chair a national commission titled The Courage to Love: Implications for Care, Research, and Public Policy to Reduce Infant Mortality. The commission clearly recognized that to begin with a call for the courage to love in response to such a grave concern as infant mortality is to invite being dismissed derided or trivialized in government or other policy circles. Yet we contend that failure to address lovelessness as perhaps the most significant risk factor in poor pregnancy outcomes is to collude in the silencing of the voices of women who experience the death of infants most immediately and intimately. As one of my commissioners, Billy Avery, an African-American womanist, put the case bluntly, as a commissioner, she declared, "Our infants are dying because their mothers are dying. They are in dead relationships." And again, I don't believe that to be hyperbolic. I believe it to be nuanced and subtle and true to the bone. At the heart of our findings and recommendations is the call to engage with mothers in mutually supportive and challenging relationships. And I suspect that it is intuitively obvious to most of you, if not all of you, that there is a difference between sending bread to a client, as we might do in governance, and breaking bread with a sister. Sending bread to a client is transactional and bound by contracts, primarily, if not solely, for the exchange of goods and services. And the parties to that contract anticipate a particular outcome. In contrast, breaking bread with a sister, and we know this around the communion table at least once every week, is potentially transformational. It is characterized by a covenant to sustain the relationship through good times and bad, successes and failures. Outcomes are unpredictable and often creative. There's a difference in caring for one another transactionally and transformationally. The difficulty in following the way of love in this instance is that the language of love is unfamiliar outside of our personal lives. It must be made familiar in social circles. There is little in the way of means to measure the reality of love. It cannot be measured, it might be qualified, but it can be without question experienced. And we must create words that help us to experience the meaning, the significance of reunions and loves and entanglement. These must be part of our civic discourse. As a physician, I've argued forever, it seems, wherever there is a tear or a rent in the fabric of relationships, therein lies an excess burden of disease, despair, and premature death. And it underscores the imperative of following the way in improving the well-being and the livelihood of women and children in our nation. Love is the drive toward the unity of the separated. Reunion presupposes separation, that which belongs essentially together. We essentially belong together. We live a narrative that says that our development is in the direction of moving from utterly dependent on our mothers in utero to increasingly independent until we are finally rugged individualists. And it is a lie. In fact, our challenge is to grow from interdependence with our mothers in their womb to increasingly complex interdependent relationships as we grow older. Our challenge is not to grow individually. It is to grow in relationship and to do so with love as the drive toward the unity of the once separated. That's what I have to share with you this morning. I was sharing with Tim before we got started my anxiety about coming to you with this narrative, because it is my effort to distill what is my life's work. And my wonder and worry is, will my life's work amount to anything in terms of improving the lives and well-being of all our neighbors who are ourselves? I'm hopeful that among you are those who believe that and will engage in the way that is prescribed by our Christ. Thank you.
No, thank you, Ron. I think you've achieved what you set out to do, and it's beautiful to consider what you've brought forward this morning. And we look forward to the discussion. So let's share the question that we're going to hold together this morning in our breakout rooms. Ron, I'm going to put it in the chat, and if you want to read it and sort of introduce what you'd like folks to talk about, I think we can go from there. So,
okay.
Now there you go.
Because of my experience with Derek Chauvin, I had to get in touch with what made this work hard for me. And I'm asking you to reflect on what your own experience that makes it hard to go the way, to follow the way. What experiences in your life make it hard to live, love, as a drive toward the unity of the separated? I hope that question makes sense.
I think so, yeah, thank you. So the way we wrote it in the chat was just reflect on how for you the way is not easy. And we can share with one another in our breakout rooms this morning, what in your experience is not easy about it. I think that illustration is beautiful and also difficult for us to consider. So we're gonna have about, 25 minutes or so in breakout rooms. So you will be randomly assigned to a group of no less than three, no more than five. And if you get caught in a room where there's only one or two of you, I'll move you pretty quickly to one where you have enough folks to have a meaningful discussion. So I'm going to open these rooms. All you need to do is accept the invitation. And we'll come back at about 20, 25 minutes. So have a great time.